gives me great pleasure to introduce John Hutchinson, who will speak on a tricolor theorem for some graphs evenly embedded on OEX episode.
Right. So just three crayons needed this afternoon. Push. Oh, on.
Oh, yeah.
That's one of the colors.
Yeah. So thank you very much, Pavel, for inviting me. And I enjoy coming to these conferences immensely. In fact, when one comes to conferences, one gets the opportunity to meet with and work with quite a few people, and these are some of the people whose work I'm going to mention today, some joint, some closely parallel, and want to recognize their contributions. Of course, I'm greatly helped by following the talks of Mike Albertson and Karen Collins and Adrian and Noga, number of things. I thought I was going to be after Boyan, but we're switching around, and it would be wonderful to be after Zhu Ding, but here we go, and we are assuming that it's hard to remember things from one lecture to the next. So the first question I'll start out with to the graduate students is, what's the easiest coloring theorem you know? What's really easy? Well, the complete graph, if vertex coloring. To vertex color, the complete graph, you need n colors if you have n vertices. Or, pardon?
It's not a theorem.
It's not a theorem. Oh, okay. Well,
I would say four-color theorem.
Is the easiest? The easiest theorem is the four-color theorem.
Well, to understand.
To understand? Oh, I mean to prove. Oh. No, I mean not to understand, but to prove. To really understand so that you know the proof. I mean, trees can be two-colored. Graphs are bipartite if and only if all cycles have even lengths. So there are a few easy ones, but the easiest one that involves colorings with surfaces, and yes, I am going to be talking about surfaces, starting on the plane, which isn't always the easiest. I was interested, Boyan and I have compared notes to look at slides, and he starts out with this. So it must truly be the easiest embedding color theorem, is that which planar graphs can be two-colored, which are bipartite, and it's those where all the regions are bounded by an even number of sides. Not necessarily four, but just an even number. And why can these be two-colored? Well, why is every cycle of even length? We'll pick a cycle, and how long is that cycle? Well, it's 4 plus 4 plus 4 plus 4 minus 2, 2, 2. Well, it doesn't matter how many even numbers you add up and how many 2s you subtract, you're still even. So that's the easiest surface or bedding color theorem I know. Generally, I'll be talking about two connected graphs, but many of the things carry over, and so I would think of this as an evenly embedded graph, because if I travel around all the edges, I see six edges because I have to travel along that one twice. I've been calling these evenly embedded, and Boyan and Paul Seymour have come up with very recently the name locally bipartite, which is probably better, but I think I'll stick with my older name today. Pardon?
Well,
oh. True, but locally means it's embedded, so that locally has a property.
Vertex neighborhoods.
Yes, but when we talk about locally planar graphs, we mean they're embedded so that locally you see a planar graph. So, but let's not fight over this. They're both good terms, and right, I know. Yes, but I don't want to offend the front row. Yeah. So, But so I am going to get you thinking about these evenly embedded graphs today. And just as in general, when you have an embedded graph and you're looking at the hardest situation, in generally, modulo some parameters, you can assume you have a triangulation. Well, if I've got an evenly embedded graph, in general, the hardest case will be when I add as many diagonals as possible, and then it turns into a quadrangulation, and every even face can be quadrangulized if need be. Noga points out that it's hard to shift back and forth. I don't find that too hard, but I certainly generate the random permutation on my slides by the end of the hour, the 50 minutes, I mean. Now, one thing that Boyan and I agreed upon, since we're both talking on very similar topics, is that generally I'm going to stay orientable, and he will focus on the non-orientable case, which sometimes is the same, and then I'll talk about it, and other times it's surprisingly different. But to keep, to start us off on an orientable keel, let's, I'm going to generally let the sphere plus G handles be denoted S sub G, and one of the prime tools is Euler's formula. The number of vertices minus the number of edges plus the number of faces is 2 minus 2g. If the graph is embedded with a two-cell embedding, that means every face is contractible. That isn't, it isn't possible to cut through a face and make the graph separator, the genus, go down. If you could, you would do that, and you'd have a smaller cases, and you'd work there. But here's a nice algebraic property from which it follows there's an upper bound on the number of edges. And I want to just show you a couple things that you can do just algebraically without getting concerned about the topology, the geometry, or the algebraic topology involved. As Noga mentioned, the chromatic number of a graph that embeds on the sphere plus G handles has this wonderful simple formula, and this is best possible. I've written this for orientable surfaces. At one point, I will shift to non-orientable, and then it turns out that this is one too large for the Klein bottle. Well, when I was a graduate student in ancient times, but I'm proud that it was ancient times, that I was studying and learning the Haywood-Ringel theorem. Ringel finished his work in 68, and so, in fact, I was a graduate student about that period to 73, and I thought it would be a useful exercise to ask about evenly embedded graphs to see how many colors were needed for such graphs, because, as was mentioned this morning, the graphs that achieve this upper bound are complete graphs, and generally, they are embedded with as triangulations, so they're filled with triangles, not at all even. Just to have a colorful picture up here, this is coloring, not vertices. I want to color vertices today, but here's the coloring of the faces of seven mutually adjacent faces on the torus with every pair meeting. I guess that's not super sharp, but you know, people who are colorblind do have troubles with these talks, so that often Penny's method is necessary to announce loud and clear what the colors are. But where, and as Noga said, these colors, the Haywood formula, just comes from Euler's formula. Now, how exactly does it come from? And I thought I would just run through here what the answer is for evenly embedded graphs. It's the same proof, but as I said, I was working to see if I really understood what was going on. And so if we have a two-cell embedding on the sphere plus G handles, now if we go and we add up the face sizes, we'll get 2 times the number of edges, and each of the faces has at least 4 edges. So the number of faces is at most E over 2. Let's substitute that in. And now I've put in something bigger. And so E over 2 is less than or equal to V plus 2 times G minus 1, or the number of edges is now bounded by this. Before it was 3V plus 6 times G minus 1, so things are more constrained. And the average degree of the graph, the sum of is less than or equal to 4 plus 8 times G minus 1 over V. Do you have it? Yeah. So on the sphere, there is a vertex of degree less than 4, and this is what happens on other surfaces. Now, what is the chromatic number of evenly embedded graphs on the sphere plus G handles? It's this number. It's again square root of G. It's no longer 7 plus the square root of 48 G, but it's this number. And where does this come from? And I'll show you the calculation. It's quite straightforward. But I did this as an exercise, my first British Combinatorial Conference, where I first met Paul Erdős, talked about it. I don't think people were too interested. But since then, Nora Hartsfield has worked out quadrangulation embeddings of complete graphs and has shown that this size complete graph embeds on every surface as a quadrangulation with quadrangles for every surface except for some strange reason, the double torus just won't go. And also the Klein bottle doesn't achieve this upper bound. Let's see, what should the Klein bottle be? I don't have that formula. What should the double torus be? That is genus 2, so a little less than square root of 64. That'll be, the square root will be 7 point, da, 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 da. So this will be 12 plus something, so this should be less than or equal to 6, but you only can get 5 colors on the double torus. So where does this number come from? Well, let's give it a name. Let's call it M. And, of course, if I'm trying to prove I can M color a graph, if it's evenly embedded on the sphere plus G handles, I might as well assume I have at least M plus 1 vertices, or it's easy. I'll do this by induction. And here was the inequality that's still up on the other one. Now, let's see. What about 8 times G minus 1? It factors into that. Huh? Well, it does. You just multiply it out, and it works. And why do you factor it like that? Well, because that's what that's how you prove the Haywood Ringel upper bound works. And then this number is less than or equal to take it up 1 with a 7 and bring it down with the floor. Take that up 1. So it's less than, in fact, here we have now M plus 1 and here we have M minus 4. So what we have then is that the average degree is strictly less than M plus 1 times M minus 4 over V. V is at least M plus 1. So the average degree is strictly less than M. And then again, this is the second easiest, or maybe tied for easiest, way to prove coloring theorems. If you have a vertex of degree at most M minus 1, you remove it. You M color the remaining graph, but there's just M minus 1 vertices there, so there's just M minus 1 colors, and so the coloring extends. And that's how you prove this, and then that's also how you prove the Ringel-Young's upper bound. Both of these theorems are valid for non-orientable surfaces, and the difference is a lot or a little, but algebraically is what I'm talking about now. Occasionally the number of handles or the number of cross-caps, 2 times the number of handles or the number of cross-caps is known as the Euler genus, and 2 minus that number is known as the Euler characteristic. Instead of handles, we can talk about cross-caps or projective planes. And if you make this algebraic translation, you get these two formulas, and they're correct and valid and best possible in the same way. I should also say, with a bit of apologies to notational, these graph embeddings really should be done more precisely and more combinatorially. Every time I write down Euler's formula, I really should be talking about the pi genus. I should talk about the specific embedding, and I highly recommend the beautiful book that Boyan and Carsten Thomason are working on, Graphs on Surfaces, where they really do this right and properly, and we're all hoping that we'll get to see a copy of it soon. I'm being a bit informal about some of the embedding details now, the combinatorial details, but they're there and they work, and so I'm being a little bit sloppy. But I think your slides were similar, and you're the author of that book. But we'll not sloppy, but informal. In a sense, isn't that the end of surface coloring theorems? The best possible upper bound, and everything's known. Well, some of us in the room have spent 30 interesting years working on some very interesting variations. And the theme that I want to talk about today is that the question that Mike Albertson asked, but I forget exactly when or where, but he asked if you had a graph embedded on a surface that was locally planar. Do you need all that 7 plus the square root of 48g plus 1 over 2, take the floor? Do you need that many colors? Can you get away with 5 colors? Now, first of all, what's locally planar? Well, here's a little part of a surface with a very busy graph. And perhaps with my current prescriptions, I can see 5 rows back that way, and I can see 5 rows out that way. And if I never see the graph disappear to form a non-contractible cycle, what I can see is that every non-contractible cycle that I can see that has length at least, that every cycle that has length at least 10 is lying flat on the surface, and non-contractible cycles have to have at least 11 edges before they disappear and go around the surface. So here I can stand and I can look quite a bit that way and that way and just see locally a planar graph. So, but more topologically, he asked if all the non-contractible cycles in the embedded graph are sufficiently long, can you get away with 5 colors? And this is a beautiful result of Carsten Thomason's, that the answer is yes. And it's known from examples, as Mike mentioned, of Valentine and Fisk, that 4 doesn't work. In the first papers that Mike and I wrote in this area, we called the length of the shortest non-contractible cycle the width. This was pre-Roberts and Seymour. They were born, but not writing their Graph Miners papers yet. It now is called the edge width, and is related to the face width and the representativity, which no longer is a word in favor. Some referee didn't like it. And so there are many words for these concepts, but today I am going to, highlighted in yellow, talk about the width or the edge width, the length of the shortest non-contractible cycle. And Carsten Thomason has proved that if all the non-contractible cycles of a graph embedded on a surface are at least 2 to something like 8g, exponential in the genus, but if they're long, where it depends upon the genus, then the graph can be 5-colored. And his result also carries over for non-orientable surfaces. And so in my even quadrangularized way, I wondered, this is the 1990s, about a similar question for evenly embedded graphs, and Raphael Robinson actually also asked David Gale this question when I had the good fortune to be at the Math Science Research Institute. Maybe he was thinking about the torus specifically. So again, now why did Mike asked about five colors. Well, five is four plus one, and I guess he knew you couldn't get away with four. And so if you just have one extra color, can you five color? And the answer is yes. So the analog would be that 2 plus 1 is 3. You can two-color evenly embedded graphs in the plane. If you have one extra color, can you color them on surfaces, provided all non-contractible cycles are sufficiently long? And I think a few years, not many before, Steve Fisk and Boyan had proved that for all surfaces, you could always four-color if the non-contractible cycles are long. And I worked out first a proof for orientable surfaces. And I won't give you the reference because even though it was in Journal of Combinatorial Theory Series B, but there's some awful proofs in there. There's some... I tried to follow some of the very, very nice proofs of Karsten Thomasson, and some of it is nice when it follows him, and then there are other places I had to get in and work too hard. And I had just finished working pretty hard on the technical details, so I'm saying if you ever looked at the paper, don't read the proofs that start getting discouraging. But luckily, just as I was about to think about non-orientable surfaces, I believe Karsten told me about Young's paper that was just appearing that has this remarkable result that if you have a quadrangulation on the projective plane, and even if the non-contractible cycles are long, this one, obviously, 1, 2, 3, 6, 5, they have length 5, but even if you built this up, if the graph was not bipartite, then ping, you need four colors. So that was really lucky because I probably would have tried to prove that for some time. It's not that the theorem does not generalize to non-orientable surfaces, and that's Boyan will talk about some of the very recent work that is going on in that area. But what I would like to talk about today is this theorem and a new, better, shorter, different proof that Paul Seymour suggested to me. So and I'll show you the components of my proof and where the going gets really tough. And it turns out that you can either dig in and do things from first principles, and I'm sure someone can do it in a better way than I did it, or one can turn to Robertson-Seymour graph miners theory and apply a result there that I'll tell you about. Now, again, you can vote and argue which you think is easier or better, because this comes from graph miners 7. And if some of you have looked at those are each long, substantial papers, but they're terribly important, and once it's there, we might as well use it. So I'd like to talk about some of the very nice ideas involved there, and then what that result is, and then how we can zoom along pretty effectively and get the result. So suppose that we have, as always, a graph evenly embedded on an orientable surface, and suppose we were fortunate enough to be able to find some cycles that have five important properties. They're non-contractible and non-separating. If I were to cut along them, I would sprawling open the handles and I'd get down to the plane. Aha, remember the plane, you just need two colors, so that's hopeful. I need them to have even length so that when I open them up, I'm not all of a sudden getting some odd cycles. I need to get down to my two-color theorem. They need to be separated, and they need to be at distance at least four apart from each other, so that I'm going to do some alterations on the coloring, and when I do the alterations, I don't want to run into each other, and I also want to make sure that the alterations don't run into each other from the left and the right. So suppose I could find such a set of cycles. Then you'll see that, in fact, then I'm in great shape because I cut each of these cycles. Now, I keep a copy of each of the cycles when I open them up. So C1 is here, and over here is C1 prime, and C2 and C2 prime. And I'm down to a planar graph. Even if these are quadrangulations, these have even length, and I can two-color it. Great, two-color. But wait a minute. How do you put the two colorings back together? Suppose that on this one, on this copy, it went A, B, A, B. But over here, by it just happens, it came out B, A, B, A. And you've got to take the two color and put it back together. But we've got a third color. So over here, let's change the A's to C. And here, I can't just change. I've got to make two changes. I've got to make A, B, and B, C. So I have to go out one level. And here I'll start making a change by making the B's up to C's. I keep the A's around. And then I can change this to a B and this to a C. And B and C. And so, look, now I've got B, C, B, C, B, C, B, C. I put them together. And I've used the third color to get the two to fit together. And so if I can find these even length cycles that whose cutting along them makes the graph planar, then I'm in great shape. And how do I find, yes, we can find these cycles, and how do you find them? Either you do a lot of grubby work, or you see how Robertson Seymour can help out. So how do you find one of these, how do you find these even length cycles whose chopping along which is going to take us down to the plane? Well, find the shortest non-contractible cycle in the graph. It might be it's separated. All right, well, if it's separated, let's keep going. Now find again the shortest non-contractible cycle in the graph. It might separate. But if it separates them, then we've gotten down to bits of torus after a while, and now find the shortest non-contractible cycle. Eventually, we're going to find one that is non-separating, that really cuts the torus. I mean, if I cut it, the torus will spring open. I was hoping that was even, so suppose it's odd. Look at the shortest path that goes in the graph that goes from one side of C to the other. These are orientable, and that makes sense in lots of ways. And so find the shortest path going from one side to the other, and we'll call that C prime. But maybe that's odd. Well, if the first C is odd and the second one is also odd, the sum is even, which is what I'm looking for, except, remember, I need this buffer zone. I need a cycle, and I need another cycle. In fact, to be careful, I'm going to take a cycle, and I'm going to find cycles on either sides that are buffer zones, and this one hits itself, so there's no buffer zone. I mean, it bangs into it. It's not a simple cycle. And so I want to find in this homotopy class, if you like, I want to find a simple cycle and one that I can, that the distance from one side to the other is at least 4. And this is where Robertson Seymour theory enters in, because their theory tells us that if you have any graph that you like on a certain surface, then there is a constant depending on the genus of the surface and the graph, so that if another graph is embedded with edge width, all non-contractible cycles at least that long, then the graph contracts to H. Then we can find this H as a minor inside our graph. And what does it mean to contract? What does it mean to be a minor? Well, either you can throw away edges and you can throw away vertices, or you can take an edge and contract it, join to those two those two down. And so what we need is this non-contractible, non-separating cycle with some buffer, parallel cycles, buffer zones on either side. And either I want one, I take one that goes around a handle, or I want one that goes the opposite direction, or one that is homotopic to the sum. And maybe that picture got a little bit unattractive. So on, imagine a torus, or if this is a part of a little handle, something. What I really want to find inside my graph, what the H is that Robertson Seymour minor theory should give me, is a graph that looks like this. And it contains five red stripes one way, five blue stripes the other, and then five stripes that are the homotopic to the sum of the two of them. But wait a minute. Wait a minute. Contractions. That's what minors do for you. And if you have a graph on the surface and you contract an edge, the remaining graph still embeds on the surface. You never contract a loop. A loop would squish the torus. But we're just taking an edge, a non-loop edge, and contracting. But this is going to kill the quadrangulations. I mean, if you contract like that, you lose your quadrangles, and I've got to stay in that class. But luckily, I'm not asking for anything very sophisticated in this search. First, I'm asking for a certain kind of cycle, a non-contractible cycle, a non-separating cycle, and it turns out that this is simple enough that if a graph contracts to one of these, it actually contains. If it, in fact, contains a cycle, which would contract to the one you want, but you can actually find a cycle in there. And if I really want two disjoint homotopic cycles, again, this is such a simple subgraph H that if the graph minors tells me it contracts to that, actually, it contains it, so I really can get what I want, and I don't need to worry. This danger doesn't come up. So in fact, pick a handle, think of a homotopy type of a cycle that goes around this way, and then one that is orthogonal that goes the other way, and another that is the sum, and these are the structures I'm looking for, and then their general theory tells me that if I have any graph embedded with sufficiently large edge width, then I can find not only all three of these types of cycles, but also with parallels, with five of them, parallel and disjoint, which are the buffer zones that I need. And again, the idea is that if one of these is odd and if the other one is odd, then there's some is going to be even in these quadrangulations. So at least one of these three is even, and that's what I needed. So what the proof was, what I said a few minutes ago, you find these even length cycles and you cut them and you go down to the plane and you recolor. You color, and in fact, the third color that appears here or maybe on the first neighbor of a cycle, these third colors won't interfere with each other because I've insisted that the cycles where I cut are at least four apart, and so no two C's will ever be connected. So about a month ago, a number of us were attending a graph coloring workshop, very fine workshop that Mike Albertson organized at the SIAM Discrete Math Meetings. And Zhuding Zhu gave a fine talk and got all of us thinking about circular chromatic numbers, which he's done. And obviously, if you listen to the speakers, everybody is going circular these days. And what I realized was that yes, I'm. this process is three coloring. I'm using a third color, but I'm not really three coloring. This is taking a two-colored cycle and using two different colors, so it's still a two-coloring, but from a set of three colors. And here again, each one of these cycles, I've introduced a third color, but I've really taken a two-coloring and I've rearranged it, so it's another kind of two-coloring. And that begins to make you think, you better study these other kinds of variations, because this isn't a very hardy three-coloring. It's not got three colors all over the place. They're happening in a very controlled way. Here's, this isn't uncontrolled, but this really uses three colors, A, B, C, A, B, C, and we could not possibly extend that to a two-coloring of an inner cycle. It's inherently three-colored. But these are just using two colors locally and on each cycle. So I asked myself what the circular chromatic number could be. And I'll put up a few names. It seems that quite a number of people started thinking about this in the last month or 2 months, so that there's all sorts of interest in the room. There are many people who are perhaps even thinking about it as I talk, because they're very they're deep into that problem. But I thought I would just show you how this is an easy exercise in why the circular chromatic number for these graphs that I'm talking about is 2 plus epsilon. 3 isn't the right answer. It should be a small fraction down near 2. And again, I'll repeat a little bit quickly, but Adrian and Noga and Karen and many people have reminded us, what is a 5-2 coloring or a 5-halves circular coloring? I want to use the colors, the numbers modulo 5, and two adjacent vertices must receive colors that are either 2 or 3, and I've 5-halves colored the 5 cycle, which is what everybody does, but I'm about to do 7/3 coloring too, because I want to that. But again, what was happening with my cycles before I had these cycles put down? But now imagine these cycles going around a handle. And I go down to the plane, and I two-color with now 0 and 1. And suppose that over here I've got 0, 1, 0, 1, and over on the other side I've got 1, 0, 1, 0. What should I put here? Well, I'm in trouble, because it looks like I need two more colors, but I don't. So what should I... how can I use these to get a 5-halves coloring? First of all, let's think of this as colored now with 0 and 2. That's a legal circular coloring, 0 and 2. And let's back up. That's the whole idea of these parallel non-contractible cycles, that I'm finding a whole bunch, I find a width, I pad it in. And over here I've got 2, 0, 2, 0. And on this one, I have 0, 2, 0, 2. And let's go back over here. Let's back up a few steps to this point. And believe me, I've copied that correctly. And now what I can do here is go 4, 2, 4, 2. Those are legal. So these are the colors across. And now I can go 1, 4, 1, 4. And then I can go 3-1-3-1, and then look what fits here on the problematic cycle. I can go 0-3-0-3, and this is a valid coloring on both sides. So in fact, I've used this little device to shift my colorings around, and have gotten a 5-2 coloring, provided I can find these even-length non-contractible cycles and I can find a whole bunch of them. Well, that worked well enough that what happens... how about making that fraction a little smaller? See, 5-2 coloring. 5 is 2 times 2 plus 1, so now let's try a 5-7/3 is smaller. And in fact, here's a 7-3 coloring. two adjacent vertices have to be, the colors have to be at least 3 apart modulo 7. So so here is a coloring of the 7 cycle. And in fact, if I give myself more width and I've got a two-colored cycle and two-colored cycle, they're incompatible, then back up and start using this transition to change from one parity to the other parity using these 7 different colors, but always keeping them at least 3 apart, modulo 7. And so what's true is that if you have a graph on an orientable surface, then if the width is large enough, and now I'm talking about evenly embedded graphs, then the circular chromatic number is at most the same game works, and this would be this 2 plus epsilon, and this epsilon really involves an n, which really involves is in here in the length of the edge width. The epsilon depends upon the edge width, and Zhuding Zhu had worked this out with a student, and now at last week at the conference and this week, a variety of people have been working on both this problem and an extension to Eulerian even triangulations, and here are some of the names that I caught, and a number of people are in the room, so Boyan will talk about this a little bit, and this list may be too short or too long, but this is certainly a work in progress about the circular that of these particular graphs on surfaces and what their circular chromatic numbers are. Oh yeah, the red. 5 cycle is meant to mean that it's a slight change of topic. So if you've had a large lunch or you're deep into a problem, there's a slight change of topic if you felt like rejoining or leaving the conversation. We got off to circular chromatic numbers. I want to take a moment to also connect these results with some results Mike Albertson and I have on coloring extension theorems. He began the conference talking about these and very kindly left out, on purpose. We talked about this and left off the work that we've done. It turns out that there are more applications of finding these nice even length cycles in evenly embedded graphs. Again, either using working hard yourself or using Robertson-Seymour theory, if you have an evenly embedded graph which has large enough width, then you can find these even-length, non-contractible cycles that planarize and that are as far apart as you'd like. And so Mike and I have looked at some of the following questions, some of the following variations. As you heard him talk, but suppose you forgot, suppose you pre-color some vertices of a graph, and he's talked about general graphs, he's talked about planar graphs. We'll now look at graphs on surfaces, and my evenly embedded or locally planar, locally bipartite graphs. Suppose you have a bipartite planar graph, and you pre-color some vertices with 2 colors. Can you extend this to a 2 coloring of the entire graph? Well, no. If you want a 2 color, there's only one 2. Once you've decided on what is going to be aqua and what is going to be blue, then the rest is fixed. And I've messed up here by changing the parity. But what if the 2 colors are just a little bit further apart? Those are 2 apart. Those are 4 apart. What can you do? Well, suppose you had 3 colors this was what Mike talked about first, you could start coloring around the blue, everything would be happy. We've expanded and now we've got to the trouble region. And if we had another color, chartreuse, then what we could do is change, keep the B's going and change the alternate ones to C's and then keep these pre-colored vertices there. So if we had an extra color and the pre-colored vertices are at least four apart, then the coloring will extend. So in fact, if you have a bipartite planar graph and you three-color a set of vertices that are at least four apart, it extends to a three-coloring of the whole graph. And what his, what his theorem really is that he told you about was that if you have, it has nothing to do with planar, and I was just doing bipartite because that's what I'm talking about, but if you have an R-chromatic graph and you have a set of vertices that are pre-colored with R plus 1 colors, then this will extend to an R plus 1 coloring of the whole graph if the pre-colored vertices are far enough apart. And then he and I looked at the situation of graphs on surfaces. And as Mike mentioned, here's a situation when you, if you have an extra color, you can do these extensions. But it turns out that on surfaces, the extra color that you used isn't used very much, or you can keep control of it, so that, in fact, the result we have there is, again, we have a locally planar graphs. We have a graph embedded on the sphere plus G handles with all non-contractible cycles long. Then, remember, Carsten Thomason says you can five-color such a graph. If you have a set of vertices that you pre-color with five, and they're far enough apart, then the five coloring will extend. You don't need an extra color. You can keep track of the other color. And there is a similar even result. I don't know if this is making it better or worse. See, you're supposed to, I'm trying to cut out the respectively so you can read the theorems. Now, if you have an evenly embedded graph with large edge width, then if you three-color a set of vertices that are now at least 10 apart, then the three-coloring will extend. And the proof combines the two ideas that I've, well, two ideas. One Mike talked about, and the other that that I've been talking about, is if you've got a pre-coloring on a vertex, then you do something so you get to a graph that you can color, and if the pre-coloring is correct, you're happy. If there's another color around that you can make an alteration with, then you can do so right there. Or if not, you change the neighbors, which are preventing you from putting the pre-color where you want. And so you need to be able to pre-color around the vertex. You need to rearrange the colors around the vertices in P. You need to be able to rearrange things around the cycles, which are taking you down to the plane. And you need to are able to do things like the problem comes up is when the vertices in P actually are on your cycles and your extra color may be getting in trouble, but then you can push the cycle a bit and get the P's away from the cycles. So you can do the cycle recoloring and you can do the pre-coloring on the vertices separately. Well, I think my time is just about up, so I will just conclude with an advertisement for the Friday 9:30 talk that Boyan is going to talk about, because again, Carsten Thomason's talk, five-color theorem is for all surfaces. My quadrangulation three-color theorem was just for orientable, because there are quadrangulations of the projective plane that need four colors. In fact, they hardly need four colors. if there are no contractible three cycles, it turns out they can be four-colored with the fourth color appearing only once. Now, that's hardly four-colorable at all. And that allows us to do a four-color extension theorem on the projective plane. But what's going? That's the projective plane. What's going on with other surfaces? And Boyan and Paul Seymour have worked out a result that he'll be telling us about winding number and the results that they have. I mean, you can't possibly read that, so I'll switch it off pretty quick. But this is what he's talking about. You know, on one of the things that he'll talk about in NICE techniques. Last summer, at Boyan's conference in Slovenia, Dan Archdeacon, Nakamoto, Nagami, Ota, and I began some work along these lines of looking at non-contractible surfaces, non-orientable surfaces, and quadrangulations, and finding situations in which the chromatic number is four or more, that you can't get away with three, and they, N and O have continued their work too. Nakamoto was just speaking about it at the Kalamazoo meetings. And there's some lovely ideas in the proof, but clearly at the end of 50 minutes is not the time to try and tell them to you, but they relate to some of the things your students been working on and doing and that you mentioned in your talk too. But I will quit at this point and just recommend many of the fine talks that are coming up where some of these themes will reemerge and some of the latest results will be, I'm sure you'll be hearing about. Thank you.